A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to unpack why property gets treated as a safe haven investment when, on the surface, it makes almost no sense. If diversification is risk management 101, parking your wealth in a single condo is the opposite of diversified. But at scale, if you're a holding company buying property across 15 countries and building financial products on top of it, suddenly you've baked in that diversification. So the question is, who actually owns all this investment property? Which group drives the bubbles? And what kind of financial vehicles are we talking about when we say institutions are in the game?
This hits at exactly the right moment. Vancouver just released its 2025 vacancy tax data, 8,200 empty units. Jerusalem's luxury tower occupancy is sitting at 34%. You've got this almost surreal situation where the investment logic says one thing and the social reality is screaming something else.
8,200 empty homes in a city where people are sleeping in vans. The cognitive dissonance is almost impressive.
Let's step back and ask, what does safe haven even mean when we're talking about a single condo in Vancouver versus a global portfolio? Because those are two completely different conversations wearing the same phrase like a borrowed coat.
The phrase is, doing a lot of work it probably hasn't earned. Safe haven. You hear that and you think Swiss government bonds, gold bars in a vault, maybe treasury bills. Not a two-bedroom with a leaky faucet and a strata council that can't agree on elevator maintenance.
In finance, a safe haven is supposed to be an asset that holds its value or appreciates during market turmoil. Low correlation with equities, low volatility, high liquidity. Property fails on at least two of those, often all three. It's illiquid by design. You can't sell a condo in 20 minutes the way you can sell shares of Apple. And the correlation question is more complicated than most people think, which we'll get to.
The perception persists because property is tangible. You can touch it. You can stand in it and say, this is mine. There's a behavioral bias here that's almost primal. The illusion of control over a physical asset versus a number on a screen.
And this is where the psychology research gets interesting. There's a concept called the endowment effect. Once you own something, you overvalue it relative to what you'd pay for the same thing if you didn't own it. Property amplifies this because it's not just any asset, it's shelter. It feels essential in a way a stock certificate doesn't.
The tangibility is doing emotional work that paper assets can't match. But that doesn't make it actually safer. I'm thinking of my uncle, who bought a rental condo in 2019, convinced it was the safest thing he could do with his retirement money. Fast forward to 2023, the tenants stopped paying rent. It took him 8 months to get an eviction through the tribunal, and by then, the unit needed $15,000 in repairs. His safe investment turned into a part-time job and a money pit.
That's the reality the sales brochures don't show you. And your uncle's situation is almost textbook. The endowment effect made him overvalue the property just because it was his. Meanwhile, the illiquidity meant he couldn't exit when things went south. And the concentration, all his eggs in one condo-sized basket, meant there was no other part of the portfolio to cushion the blow.
How does that work in practice? If the endowment effect is so well documented, why don't people see it in themselves?
Because it's invisible from the inside. There's a related concept called the IKEA effect. People place disproportionately high value on things they've assembled or built themselves, and property is the ultimate IKEA project. You chose the neighborhood, you negotiated the price, you picked the paint color, you fixed the leaky faucet. Every hour of effort you put in becomes a psychological sunk cost that makes the asset feel more valuable to you than it would to any rational buyer.
You're not just owning an asset, you're building a story about yourself as a savvy investor, and the story is part of what you're valuing.
Stories don't show up on a balance sheet, but they absolutely drive behavior.
Let's ground this in the data. To answer the first part of the prompt, who actually owns all this investment property? What do the numbers say?
the Global REIT Association put out a report in 2024 that breaks it down. Institutional vehicles, that's REITs, private equity funds, sovereign wealth funds, hold 42% of global investment-grade real estate by value. Individual investors, and this is non-owner-occupied property, hold 31%. The remainder is corporate ownership, companies holding their own premises, and so on.
Individuals are a minority, but not a small one. 31% is still a massive slice of the pie.
Here's where it gets counterintuitive. The Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, published a working paper in March of this year, number 1234, looking at what actually correlates with rapid price appreciation in 12 global cities. Individual, speculative buying, flipping, second homes, that kind of thing, had an R-squared of 0.74 with price spikes, 0.31.
Wait, say that again. The individuals are more strongly correlated with bubbles than the big institutional money.
By a factor of more than two. And this upends the narrative most people carry around. The popular story is that Blackstone and similar giants are buying up neighborhoods and driving prices through the roof. But the data suggests individual speculative buyers are the primary bubble engine.
That's going to make some people uncomfortable.
And the mechanism makes sense when you think about it. An institutional investor like a pension fund or a REIT is buying based on discounted cash flow models, cap rates, long-term yield projections. They have investment committees and quarterly reviews. An individual speculator in a hot market is often buying on momentum, on the belief that prices only go up, on what their neighbor's house just sold for.
Anchoring to the last sale price down the street, and assuming the line goes up forever.
And there are structural factors that make this worse for individuals. Mortgage leverage amplifies both gains and losses. In the U.S., the mortgage interest deduction effectively subsidizes borrowing. In many countries, capital gains on a primary residence are tax-exempt or partially exempt. These policies were designed to encourage homeownership, but they also create incentives for speculative behavior at the margins.
The tax code is essentially telling individuals, please, leverage up and bet on property.
It's not quite that blunt, but the incentives point in that direction. Take the mortgage interest deduction. If you're in the top tax bracket, every dollar of mortgage interest effectively costs you 60 cents after the deduction. That's a huge subsidy to leverage. And the capital gains exemption, up to $250,000 for an individual, $500,000 for a couple on a primary residence in the U.S. That's a massive tax-free return you can't get from any other asset class. The government is literally riding the incentive structure for speculation.
The individual investor internalizes none of the systemic risk. If one person overleverages and defaults, that's their problem. If 10,000 people do it simultaneously, that's a financial crisis. But what's the mechanism there? How does individual speculation actually tip into systemic risk?
It's a cascade. Individual speculators tend to cluster in the same markets, the hot neighborhoods, the cities everyone's talking about. They use similar levels of leverage because mortgage products are standardized. When the market turns, they all face margin pressure at the same time. If they can't service the debt, they sell. Those sales push prices down, which triggers more distress among other leveraged owners. It becomes a self-reinforcing downward spiral. The institutions, by contrast, tend to have longer time horizons and lower leverage ratios. They can sit through a downturn without being forced to sell.
Which brings us to the case studies. You mentioned Vancouver's vacancy data.
Vancouver's 2025 property tax data is fascinating. 8,200 empty units, 68% of those are owned by individuals, not corporations. And those individuals are overwhelmingly concentrated in the top 5% of income earners. These aren't accidental vacancies. Someone bought a pie to tear or a parking spot for capital, and the unit sits dark 11 months a year.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper, a condo that exists only as a line item on someone's balance sheet.
Then you flip to Jerusalem, and the pattern is completely different. The 2025 Municipality Property Registry Analysis shows luxury tower occupancy at 34%. So two-thirds empty, but here, 72% of those units are owned by foreign holding companies registered in Delaware or Luxembourg, the global mailbox of choice. So in Vancouver, the vacancy problem is driven by wealthy individuals. In Jerusalem, it's institutional structures hiding behind corporate registrations. Same outcome, empty units in a housing crisis, but completely different ownership patterns.
Which means any policy response has to be calibrated to who's actually doing the buying. A foreign buyer tax might work in Vancouver, but miss the mark in Jerusalem if the buyers are already routing through shell companies. How do you even design a policy that hits both patterns?
That's the second-order problem. And this connects to something Singapore figured out years ago. Their global investor program requires institutional investors to hold property through REITs for at least 5 years. You can't just buy and flip. Compare that to Dubai's freehold system, where individuals can buy and sell immediately with essentially no friction.
Which system produces more stability?
Singapore's, by a wide margin. The holding period requirement dampens speculative churn. Dubai has had boom-bust cycles that make Bitcoin look stable, and I don't say that lightly. In 2008, Dubai property prices fell over 50% in a matter of months. The 5-year lockup forces institutions to think like long-term owners rather than traders.
What about the individual speculator in Singapore? Does the lockup apply to them too?
Singapore uses stamp duties, essentially a transaction tax, that scales with how quickly you sell. Sell within 1 year, you pay a 12% seller's stamp duty. Hold for 3 years, it drops to 4%. Hold more than 3 years, it goes to zero. It's a behavioral nudge baked into the tax code. You can still speculate, but the government takes a big enough bite out of any short-term gain that it stops making sense for most people.
Singapore is taxing the speculative behavior directly, rather than trying to ban it. That's elegant.
Singapore's property market is not cheap. It's one of the most expensive in the world, but it's remarkably stable. You don't get the wild swings you see in Vancouver or Sydney or Toronto. The policy framework recognizes that you can't stop people from wanting to invest in property, but you can change the incentive structure so that the least socially useful behavior, short-term flipping, becomes uneconomical.
Individuals are the bubble drivers, but institutions are where the real financial engineering happens. Let's unpack how they structure these investments.
This is where it gets genuinely interesting. The flagship vehicle is the REIT-TREIT Real Estate Investment Trust. And the key thing to understand is that a REIT is an equity vehicle. You're buying shares in a company that owns property. It's not a bond, it's not a mortgage product. It's equity in a property-owning entity.
When I buy a share of a REIT, I own a tiny slice of a warehouse in Rotterdam and an apartment building in Dallas.
And the structure matters because REITs are required to distribute at least 90% of their taxable income as dividends. That's the trade-off for not paying corporate tax at the entity level. The dividends flow through to shareholders, who pay tax at their individual rates. This makes REITs income-oriented investments. They're designed to generate yield, not just capital appreciation.
The diversification happens at the portfolio level. Blackstone's REIT WT holds 4,200 properties across 15 countries and 8 asset classes.
Multifamily, industrial, office, retail, hospitality, data centers, self-storage, student housing. You name a building type, they probably own some. And that geographic and sectoral spread is what creates genuine diversification. If office buildings in San Francisco are struggling, maybe their data centers in Frankfurt are booming. The correlation within the portfolio is managed.
That's just one type of vehicle. The prompt asked about mutual funds, hedge funds, the whole taxonomy. How do we map all of these?
Let's map it. REITs are the equity layer, own the property. Then you've got CMBS, commercial mortgage-backed securities. These are debt vehicles. A bank originates a bunch of commercial mortgages, bundles them together, and sells bonds backed by those mortgage payments. You're not buying the building, you're buying a claim on the debt.
If the borrower defaults, the CMBS holder is in the line of creditors, not standing in the lobby with the keys.
And then there are CLOs, collateralized loan obligations, backed by real estate debt. These are even further removed from the actual property. You're buying a tranche of a pool of loans, and your payout depends on where you sit in the capital structure. Senior tranches get paid first, but earn less. Equity tranches get paid last, but earn more, and they take the first losses.
This is starting to sound like the mortgage-backed securities that caused the 2008 crisis, just with commercial property instead of residential.
The structure is similar, yes, but the underlying assets and the scale are different. And this is where mutual funds versus hedge funds versus private equity come in. A mutual fund like the Vanguard Real Estate Index, ticker VNQ, passively tracks REITs. You buy one share, you get exposure to a basket of REITs, which in turn own thousands of properties. Low-cost, liquid, diversified. The expense ratio is something like 0.12%.
For the price of a sandwich, you get global real estate exposure you can sell in seconds. But what's actually happening under the hood? If I buy VNQ, am I getting the same thing as buying a REIT directly?
Not exactly, and this is an important distinction. When you buy VNQ, you're buying a fund that holds shares of multiple REITs. You're one step removed from the property. The fund manager is making decisions about which REITs to overweight or underweight based on the index methodology. You're paying that 0.12% for someone to handle the rebalancing and dividend reinvestment. If you bought the REITs individually, you'd have to manage all of that yourself, and your transaction costs would eat into returns.
The mutual fund is adding a layer of convenience and diversification on top of the REIT structure, which is itself a layer on top of the actual buildings. We're stacking financial abstractions.
Each layer changes the risk profile. Hedge funds are a completely different animal. They're not in this for long-term yield. A fund like Pershing Square or Citadel might use real estate derivatives, options on REITs, or short positions to bet on price movements. They're doing arbitrage and directional bets, not buy and hold. Their time horizon is measured in months, sometimes weeks. Private equity, Blackstone, KKR, Brookfield, does direct ownership with 7 to 10 year hold periods. They buy properties, sometimes entire portfolios, improve operations, and sell at a profit. The fund structure is closed-end. Investors commit capital for the full term and can't redeem early. This illiquidity lets them ride out market cycles in a way that publicly traded REITs can't always do, because REIT investors can sell at any time.
Private equity's illiquidity is actually a structural advantage in a downturn. They can't be forced to sell at the bottom because their investors can't demand their money back.
And it's a feature, not a bug. The lockup period aligns the fund manager's incentives with the long-term performance of the assets. Compare that to a publicly traded REIT. If the share price drops, investors can flee, and the REIT might be forced to sell properties into a falling market just to meet redemption requests. The vehicle structure determines who bears what risk and when.
Which brings us to the knock-on effect you hinted at earlier, the feedback loop between these financial products and the broader market.
This is the part most coverage misses. When REITs and CMBS are traded on public markets, property prices become correlated with stock market sentiment. The safe haven narrative falls apart because your safe real estate investment is now getting dragged around by whatever the S&P 500 is doing.
Show me the data on that.
March 2020. REITs fall 35% in a matter of weeks. Direct property values, the actual buildings, only fell about 5%, and even that was partly an appraisal lag artifact. The buildings didn't suddenly become worth a third less, but the stock market panic hit REIT shares just as hard as anything else.
The financial vehicle introduced volatility that the underlying asset didn't have.
Then the recovery tells the other half of the story. By 2022, REITs had recovered 50% from the lows. Direct property was still down about 10% in real terms. The financial vehicle overshot on the way down and on the way back up. If you held the actual building, your ride was much smoother, but you also couldn't sell it during the panic even if you wanted to.
Which is either a feature or a bug depending on whether you're trying to sleep at night or get your money out. But doesn't that overshooting create its own problems? If REITs are swinging 35% while the buildings are only moving 5%, someone is getting whipsawed.
And it's usually the retail investor who bought the REIT because they wanted real estate exposure and didn't realize they were also buying equity market correlation. They see a 35% drawdown, panic, sell at the bottom, and lock in a loss that had nothing to do with the actual value of the buildings. The financial vehicle betrayed them precisely because it was too liquid.
The liquidity that makes REITs attractive is also what makes them dangerous for the wrong kind of investor.
It's the paradox of liquidity. The ability to sell at any moment means you might sell at exactly the wrong moment. Direct property forces you to sit through the downturn because you literally can't find a buyer. That sounds like a disadvantage, and in some ways it is, but it also prevents you from making a panic-driven mistake.
The 2023 to 2024 commercial real estate correction in the U.S. makes this even clearer.
Office REITs lost 45% of their value, but CMBS holders, the debt guys, faced actual defaults. Tenants stopped paying rent, buildings couldn't cover their debt service, and the bonds took real losses. The equity got crushed, but the debt holders were the ones facing binary outcomes. Either they got paid or they didn't.
The financial vehicle structure determines the shape of the pain. Equity holders get diluted and devalued. Debt holders face default risk. And somewhere underneath all of it, there's an actual building with actual tenants, or in some cases, no tenants.
That building doesn't care what financial product was built on top of it, but the investors care enormously. If you bought a CMBS tranche thinking it was safe because it was backed by real estate, and then the office building in your pool goes vacant and the loan defaults, your safe haven just turned into a write-down.
Can we make that concrete? What does that actually look like for someone who bought into one of these products?
Imagine you bought a AAA-rated CMBS tranche in 2021, backed by a pool of office buildings in major U.S. cities. The rating agency told you it was safe. The underlying properties were valued at $1 billion, and your tranche had first claim on the cash flows. Then, 2023 hits. Two of the buildings in the pool lose their anchor tenants. Occupancy drops below 50%. The buildings can't cover their debt payments. The loan goes into special servicing. Suddenly, your AAA bond is being downgraded, and the market value drops 40 cents on the dollar. You thought you owned a safe bond backed by real estate. What you actually owned was a claim on office building cash flows in a market where nobody wants office buildings.
The rating didn't protect you because the rating was based on assumptions about occupancy and rent growth that turned out to be wrong.
Same story as 2008, just with a different asset class. The models assumed historical correlations would hold. They didn't.
This is where the misconception busting needs to happen. Property is not a safe haven because it's real and tangible. It's illiquid. It's concentrated. And when you hold it through financial vehicles, it's correlated with markets.
The second misconception, that institutional investors are the main cause of housing bubbles. The BIS data shows the opposite. Individual speculative buyers are more strongly correlated with price spikes. The institutions are often the ones buying after the crash, not driving the run-up.
Which is its own kind of problem. Vulture capitalism picking over the wreckage of a bubble individuals inflated. But it's a different problem than the one most people think they're angry about.
The third misconception is that REITs and mutual funds are interchangeable. They're not. A REIT is an operating company that owns property. A mutual fund is a pooled investment vehicle that can hold REITs, bonds, direct property, or any combination. Different legal structures, different tax treatment, different liquidity profiles.
If someone says, I want real estate exposure, the next question should be, through what vehicle, with what liquidity, at what tax cost, and correlated with what?
That's exactly the right checklist. And this brings us to the practical question. If you're an individual investor who wants real estate exposure, what should you actually do?
Because the default move, buy a second property, rent it out, hope it appreciates, is looking less like a safe haven and more like a concentrated, illiquid bet with high transaction costs.
The transaction costs alone are brutal. Real estate agent commissions, legal fees, stamp duty or transfer taxes, inspection costs. You're down 5 to 10% just getting in and out. Compare that to buying a globally diversified REIT ETF with an expense ratio of 0.12% and zero transaction friction.
The actionable takeaway is, if you want the asset class exposure without the concentration risk, a REIT ETF does the job at a fraction of the cost and with actual liquidity.
VNQ for U.S. exposure, or there are global REIT ETFs that spread across countries. You're getting hundreds of properties, multiple asset classes, professional management, and you can sell in seconds if you need the cash. It's not glamorous. Nobody's going to invite friends over to look at their ETF shares, but it's a vastly more rational way to get the exposure.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability in investment form. No curb appeal, but it works.
For policymakers, the data suggests something specific. Curbing individual speculative buying, vacancy taxes, foreign buyer taxes, flipping restrictions, is more effective at dampening bubbles than regulating institutional investors. Because individuals are the primary bubble drivers.
Vancouver's vacancy tax is a direct attempt at this. Tax the empty unit, make it costly to leave property dark, and you change the calculus for the individual speculator.
The early data suggests it's working. Not perfectly and not overnight, but the number of empty units is declining. The tax creates a carrying cost that makes the buy and hold empty strategy less attractive. The carrying cost changes the math. If you're paying 1% of assessed value per year in vacancy tax and the property is appreciating at 3%, your net return drops to 2%. At that point, a government bond starts looking competitive, and the bond doesn't come with strata meetings.
The tax doesn't need to eliminate the behavior. It just needs to make the alternative look better.
That's the beauty of it. You're not banning anything. You're just making the socially harmful option slightly less profitable, and human behavior shifts. Most speculative buying is marginal. It happens because the expected return is a little bit higher than the next best option. Narrow that gap, and the capital flows elsewhere.
What can a regular person actually do with this information, beyond their own investment decisions?
Check your local property registry. A lot of cities now have open data portals where you can see who owns what, which units are vacant, and whether the owner is an individual or a corporate entity. Use that data to advocate for policy changes. Show up at city council meetings with numbers, not just anecdotes.
Data beats outrage in a policy debate every time, or at least it should.
The other thing listeners can do is simply be aware of the narrative they're being sold. When someone tells you property is a safe haven, ask, safe for whom, under what conditions, and correlated with what? The financial industry benefits enormously from the property as safe haven myth because it creates demand for the products they build on top of it.
Property isn't safe, and it isn't a haven. But the myth persists.
Partly because it benefits the financial industry that creates products on top of it. Partly because it benefits governments that want rising property values to drive consumer confidence and tax revenue. Partly because it benefits homeowners who want to believe their largest asset is also their safest. The myth has a constituency.
Partly because there's a kernel of truth buried in there. Over very long time horizons, in certain markets, property has been a decent store of value. The problem is extrapolating that to every market, every time horizon, and every ownership structure.
The kernel of truth gets stretched into a blanket statement that covers a multitude of sins. And as more cities adopt vacancy taxes and transparency measures, the data will get better. But the open question is whether better data changes behavior or just shifts ownership structures into new, harder-to-track forms.
The shell game adapts. If vacancy taxes target individuals, money flows into holding companies. If holding companies face scrutiny, the structures get more complex. The underlying incentive, park wealth somewhere tangible that generates returns, doesn't go away.
That's why this conversation matters beyond the investment angle. This is about who cities are for. When 34% of luxury units in Jerusalem are occupied, when 8,200 units in Vancouver sit empty, the market is not allocating housing to people who need it. It's allocating housing to people who need a place to store capital.
Housing as a financial asset first, shelter second. The hierarchy is inverted.
The inversion is what makes the safe haven narrative so corrosive. Because if property is primarily an investment, then vacancy isn't a market failure. It's a rational choice by an investor who doesn't need the rental income. The appreciation alone justifies the carrying cost.
Until it doesn't. Until the bubble pops and the safe haven turns out to have been a speculative bet all along.
That's the moment when the individuals who drove the bubble, the ones the BIS data points to, are left holding an illiquid asset they can't sell in a market where everyone is trying to sell at once. The safe haven becomes a trap.
Which is about as far from safe as you can get. And I think that's the real gut punch here. The people most susceptible to the safe haven narrative, individual investors looking for somewhere secure to put their money, are the ones most exposed when the narrative collapses. The institutions have diversified portfolios and patient capital. The individual with one condo and a mortgage is the one who can't sleep.
The tragedy is that the tools exist to do this differently. A low-cost REIT ETF gives you the real estate exposure without the concentration, without the illiquidity, without the midnight calls about broken water heaters. But it doesn't feel like property. It doesn't scratch that psychological itch. So people keep buying condos.
The tangible asset wins the emotional argument and loses the financial one. That's a hard thing to unlearn. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, inhabitants of the Chatham Islands fashioned cooking vessels from a locally abundant schist containing up to 60% silica and trace amounts of arsenopyrite, meaning their traditional cookware was, chemically speaking, a slow-release arsenic delivery system bonded in quartz.
The pot was poisoning them and they had no idea.
And I suppose the analogy writes itself. Something that looks solid and useful, slowly leaching harm into everything it touches.
The original safe haven that wasn't. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for keeping the show running. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. And if you've got local property data from your city, vacancy numbers, ownership breakdowns, anything interesting, send it our way. We'll dig into it.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.